Paul Wright, and welcome to another programme of Out and About. Now, recently I visited the Columban Missionary Residence in Dalgan Park, situated near Navan in County Meath. And here's who I got talking with there.
Donny Hogan.
Now, Donny, where are you originally from?
From Tramore.
Tramore, County Waterford, right. Okay, when were you born and how did your life progress from day one?
1940, and then went to Sisters of Charity, Christian Brothers, and then worked for 5 years. Then came into Dalgan at the age of 22.
So Dalgan is now the missionary centre here for the seminary for the Columban missionaries, right? In
1962.
Wow, yeah. And you're the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so you arrive into Dalgan. What was it like?
It was strange, because as I say, I'd worked for 5 years and then I was coming, and the other guys would generally be 5 years younger than me. But at the same time, there were so many of us here. 41 of us came in that year. There was many left, of course, but there was altogether, during my 7 years here, there would have been, during that time, about 200 students on average here. So we had all kinds of sports activities, soccer, rugby. You know, there was a ban outside, but there was no ban inside from the point of view of the GAA. So we played everything. So there was that kind of community spirit growing up here. And yet there were Columbans coming back from the missions at the time, sometimes many of them quite broken, you know, from their experience. But then they would share with us. So we got kind of, over the years, we got insights into what we might be facing wherever we ended up, whether it was South America or Korea or the Philippines. As it turns out, I was assigned to the Philippines.
Right, okay, so how many years in total in Dalgan before you headed to the Philippines?
7 years. So that would have included a spiritual year, first year, you know, saying prayers and things like that. And then we continued the prayers afterwards, of course. So then we went philosophy, theology, and then ordination, and then out. So 23 of us were ordained from that 41. 14 of us were assigned to the Philippines. So in 1969, 11 of that 14 traveled together. We went the shortcut. In those days, you know, you kind of went around the world, ticket was a thing. So we went through New York, met our relatives, said goodbye to them there, San Francisco, and then headed, arriving in the Philippines, onto the different islands. Two of us were assigned to the island of Negros. John Brazel, his brother is still in Limerick Travel, Tony. But John, unfortunately, at the age of 44... John died suddenly. Home on holidays, jogging in Limerick, you know. But anyway, the two of us were assigned on the island of Negros, and we had a number of role models there already for us, with people like Neil O'Brien, who had eventually became part of that, what was known as the Negros Nine, because of their work with the sugarcane workers and the small settlers, helping them to realise the dignity as human beings and to stand up for their rights in a very society that had so many contrasts between those who were fabulously rich and then those who were extremely poor. So they were siding with the poor at that time. And there were false charges because at that time it was martial law. There were false charges brought up against them. Brian Gore was another one, Columban, and then the Filipino priest, and six parish leaders. So the nine of them became the Negros Nine. And if they hadn't been doing the work they were doing, they would not have been put in jail, you know. But because the work they were doing was rocking the boat, as Dom Helder Camara in Brazil said before, if I give alms to the poor, they call me a saint. If I ask why they are poor, they call me a communist. So generally, many of us would have been suspected of being communists or branded as such. So Neil then, total innocent, you know, and extremely committed to the poor. But because of this work, those powerful people all of a sudden felt threatened because the people were organizing And of course, it was in the Philippines, I think, that this people power began. That was a bit later with Cory Aquino, when Marcos was forced out. But the military actually coached the witnesses against, you know, telling them stories is what. They got the cook from the parish of Neil O'Brien to swear that Neil O'Brien was a mastermind, and to say that on such and such a date he was planning murder, multiple murder of a local mayor who he was friendly with. Neil happened to know him and his family. But this is the kind of stuff that went on.
And as Donnie Hogan just touched on, Columban missionary Neil O'Brien and eight other activists, who collectively became known as the Negros Nine, were imprisoned in the year 1984 on trumped-up charges, in an attempt to undermine their work for justice on behalf of peasant labourers on the Filipino island of Negros. So what eventually happened? The Negros Nine. Donnie Hogan.
Eventually, pressure came, and I think this is what helped us all, from outside the country. Our own families, my own mother in Tremor was part of the apostolic workers, and they were going around getting signatures for the release of the Negros Nine with Neil O'Brien. She had met Neil O'Brien outside the parish church. But the support they got from home, maybe especially the prayers of the people at home, and the pressure put on from the outside. Even RTE sent, I think it was Brian Farrell, to the States to meet President Reagan before he came to Ireland around 1984, I think it was 1984, and asked him the question, what about this Father O'Brien and his companions that are in jail in the Philippines on false charges? And Reagan commented in that interview, said, oh, he said, we will look into that, we will. And then the mother of Neil O'Brien, who was fantastic, she came out to the Philippines, spoke at an open-air mass in 1984 with about maybe 30,000 people there, all poor, and the bishop, about a quarter of a mile away from the prison where her son Neil was in jail, and she made a plea for justice and for their safe return. Here in Ireland, there was a group here campaigning, including some former Columbans who had got married and now are settled down, but they were campaigning for justice. And they eventually did get justice. When Neil O'Brien arrived home, they had this big banner at the airport, and it said something, "Welcome, Neil of the Nine Hostages."
So it was as Irish as you'd get.
So it was wonderful. But before they were released, Mrs. O'Brien, who died, of course, since, Mrs. O'Brien, with this group organizing, went into a makeshift cage outside the American embassy and presented a letter for President Reagan pleading for her son. Once Reagan came to Ireland, this impacted on him. Once he withdrew his support for Marcos, Marcos had to leave the country, you know? So I headed off with millions, billions maybe, to Hawaii for safety. Neil then was released. So, but it's, I suppose my point is, the help and the support that we got all the years that we were working in the Philippines, the prayers of the people here in Ireland, and our friends, support from our friends that were close by where we could talk things over with, this kept us going, you know?
It also helped, it was a factor in helping to bring down a tyrannical dictator, Ferdinand Marcos.
That's right. And this was the beginning of people power. All those images that went around the world, and it has been, I suppose, imitated in other countries since. And it was wonderful, really. But the cardinal in Manila at the time, it was a terrible risk, really. He went on this shortwave, Radio Veritas, which goes around Asia. He went on that station, Catholic radio station, and called the people out into the streets. The people came out in their hundreds of thousands. Now, the risk was the church could not defend them because they were facing the tanks that were coming down the streets. The church could not defend them. So it was a huge risk. It paid off. the soldiers joined the people. And it was a wonderful thing. There are pictures of nuns in front of the tanks, pleading with them and all this. So it was an exciting time, that particular time.
And you were in the middle of it yourself. I mean, you were right there in the middle of the eye of the storm, in the middle of the maelstrom, so to speak. You know, you were actually, I mean, there was other incidents that happened during that time. Tell us about these incidents, please.
But before I go on to them, just you did mention how being in the eye of the storm there. I was in the next parish to Neil O'Brien. There was about 40 Columbans on the island. Many of us attended the court hearings that were going on daily in Bacolod City, 4 hours away, trying to support him. But the stress took its toll on all of us, you know, going in and out of the jail, seeing him. It was like a Mexican jail you see in the cowboy films years ago. But the stress it did, you could see it in the way we related with each other. It was just, and Charlie Bird arrived in the middle of it all, and he was fantastic. But anyway, later on then, of course, that would be 1984. Years later, I was taken out of Negros and my assignment would have been the regional director based in Manila. Now, from the point of view of having been at the forefront or in the front line with the people, all of a sudden I was a second liner away from people, young and old, the parish kind of life. But my role would have been there, being supportive of Columbans around the Philippines, visiting them, listening to where they were at, what was the problems, and trying to show support for them. And in the middle of that, I was there from 93 to 99 in that job in Manila. In the middle of that, Des Hartford, for 1997, from Lusk in County Dublin. Des, who was a year ahead of me here in the seminary, all of a sudden, he was kidnapped. He was working on the island of Mindanao in an area which is predominantly Muslim. And his apostolate, together with a very small group of Columbans, nobody was assigned there. They had to volunteer for it. It was special because now they weren't going to be working with Christians mostly. There were some Christians there, but their primary work would have been dialogue of life with the Muslims, trying to break down barriers. Des even lived with a Muslim family, as did his companion Rufus Halley, who I mentioned later. But they really soaked in the culture. They built up trust with the people. And then all of a sudden, Des was betrayed. Someone whose daughter he was helping through college set him up, and he was kidnapped and taken away. And all of a sudden, we heard in Manila, we heard it initially from his friend, the Archbishop Capalia, who I had known personally as well. So he'd called up saying, this is what happened. There was a Filipino priest, Father Rufel. He was also kidnapped with them initially. But then he was released after a few hours, sent back to bring word to the outside world, as it were. They had demands of the government, and they were using Des as a pawn to get these demands. They claimed that the government had promised them so many things and had not delivered. So, immediately, what do you do? Our main fear, of course, we had to notify the family through our bosses here in worldwide in Ireland. Vicar General happened to be the one in charge at the time. And he was an Australian. So there was constant telephone, fax contact with him so that he could keep up the dialogue with the family. Our purpose there was reassuring the family, even though I must admit we had our own fears that something drastic could have happened, but trying to reassure the family. Then the next thing was contacting the nuncio so that the Vatican would know and support the bishops, contacting their men in charge, contacting the president. That was our primary thing at that time, to try and ensure that the safety of Des would be the number one priority. In other words, what we were afraid of was the army would go in like Rambo and shoot all around in order to rescue him, and he could get killed in the crossfire. we managed through a friend to get a letter to President Ramos. It was Ramos at the time. Got a message to him. Got a message then to the ambassador, Joe Hayes, a wonderful person, based in Beijing, but covering the Philippines. And he had been to the Philippines, so I had met him before as well. He immediately faxed President Ramos. We had our letter hand-delivered to President Ramos, and we heard from this friend of ours, Nini Guevara, who was some government official, but that it was actually discussed at the time. Ramos comes out, the president, the next day, and he makes a declaration to the press. He says, the safety of, he was a Monsignor Des Hartford, his paramount, and that's where we will try and negotiate, but his safety is paramount. So from there on, there was trying to get dialogue, what's happening, and then all of a sudden, about 2 days later, a general telephones me, and Nazareno. He says, Father Hogan, he says, we have word that Father Hartford is going to be released tomorrow morning. So basically, I went to Mindanao then early the next morning, a couple of hours plane ride, and to be there for the handing over of Des. I made an awful mistake. I telephoned the family because up to this, everything was bad news. There was talk about another group trying to take him over from the group that had kidnapped him, a more dangerous group, MNLF, Moro National Liberation Front. But I made a mistake. Because the family had only been hearing the bad news and everything was down, all of a sudden our hope lifted and I felt, well, I need to share this with the family, help them, you know. So I telephoned directly the family, didn't go through our man in Ireland. Just wanted them to hear the good news. Went down to Mindanao, waiting all day, up to the night time. Eventually, word came through. Negotiations have broken down. I headed back to Manila. I hadn't the heart to call the family. So I called our Vicar General in Ireland, Noel Conley. Asked him, would he contact the family? Tell them it was a false alarm. But I was so down after it and after your expectations. So then further negotiations, and a letter came out from Des at one stage saying he's all right, you know, but they are making demands of the government, whatever. Eventually, General Nazareno, after another maybe 5 days more, he telephones me, something is going to happen. Again, I head down to Mindanao. At this stage now, it's about 10 days since he was kidnapped. And things were really getting scary. We just didn't know what was going to happen. They weren't making any demands of the Colombians for money or anything like that. It was demands of the government with regard to issues they had. So at that stage, I headed to Mindanao. Again, I didn't tell the family this time that there was hope that because I didn't believe, you know. Waiting around again all day in another parish. Eventually, walking up and down the church, wondering what's going to happen. 10 o'clock at night, we decide nothing is going to happen. So I went back to the nearest Columban parish, went to bed. And this is now the 11th day. At about 12:15 or after, I got this call from Ireland, from Noel Conley, our man. He said, Des is released. I could not believe it. I said, Noel, we've been waiting here all day. General Nazareno has told us he's going to be released, but he has not been released. Noel says, Des is released. I said, how can that be? Then he said, he called his family. He was in the mountain, obviously access to the military base, and was given permission, this is now after midnight, to call his family. And he called just one call and he called them. And I still couldn't believe it. Anyway, I went back to bed. 15 minutes later, General Nazareno rings. Father Hartford has been released. We have him here in the camp. We will be down in the parish where you are at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning and for the handing over. I didn't know, you know, whether to accept that, or but it was confirmation.
And for those of you who've just tuned in, I'm Paul Wright and you're listening to Out and About. Thus far in the programme, I've been talking with Donnie Hogan, a Columban missionary priest who spent many years working on the missions in the Philippines. Donnie has just been explaining how his missionary colleague Des Hartford was kidnapped by rebels on the southern Filipino island of Mindanao in the year 1997. Thankfully, Des Hartford was released after 11 days in captivity. So just how did his release go? Donnie Hogan.
The next morning, all these military things, trucks come into the compound. We looking down at them. Rufus Halley was with me, a friend of Des. The Archbishop was there waiting. And Des comes up, emaciated and haggard. We had a slap-up breakfast. I don't know where we got the sausages, but we had a big breakfast ready for him. Then, anyway, after that, he began to unwind. Then our headquarters at that stage was Cagayan de Oro, which is about an hour away. So they were taking Des in the military ambulance. So I sat in with him in the military ambulance. We went to Cagayan de Oro, where there was the formal handing over, and where all the press had been contacted, and Des was interviewed and spoke about how he had been betrayed. And what a relief, you know. But that wasn't the end of it. A couple of the guys there, close to Des, including Rufus, they felt he needed to go back to where he was acting bishop, basically, in Marawi City. That city is 99% Muslim. They felt if he didn't go back, and that's where Des lived, if he didn't go back there now before wanted him to go home to Ireland, if he didn't go back there now before, they felt he might never go back because of the trauma. Whereas I was thinking, my God, the people at home, everybody has been supportive, the family worried. What happens if he goes back? What will happen? Is the risk too much? And I was dreading it. But I didn't know if I had the right to actually order him, because even though he was a Columban, his appointment had come from the Vatican because he was acting bishop, apostolic delegate. So he said he'd sleep on it. The next morning, after discerning, they said, no, I'm going home to Ireland. I'm not going back. What a relief. A few days later, I was back in Manila. There was these other foreign missionaries had worked in the area, the Belgium group, CICM, and one of their priests decided he'd go back visiting Marawi City on the bus. Ben Maes was his name. I just heard yesterday that he has since died. He got off the bus in Marawi City, was immediately kidnapped as he got off the bus. When I heard that, my heart, you know the way when your heart goes from here down to the pit of your stomach? It could have been Des. The superior of the CICM telephoned me. What were the steps you had taken to get Des released? At this stage, I had gone in, I don't know what it was, burnout, depression. I remember responding to him in a monotone. I was like, it was burnout. And told him the steps we had taken, like a robot almost, and put down the phone. Eventually he was released. But it took me quite a while to get over that. It was trauma and burnout.
I mean, you were just talking about on the phone in pre-interview research, for want of a better description, and you were just saying you are absolutely burnt out, you know. Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, yeah. It was just such a harrowing experience, you know, and, unbelievable.
Sure.
You couldn't make it up.
That's right. And about, that was October 97, January 98, my mother was 80 at that stage. January 98. There are 9 of us in the family. I was resting in one of our houses up in the hills for trying to get myself together. I could not. There was a telephone there. I could not call her. I was the only one of the nine of us who didn't actually greet her on her birthday. I felt if I'd picked up the phone, it would upset her even more, because this depression or burnout that was in me would have come across. She would have noticed my voice was dead flat, and that would really have caused her worry, you know. So, but to this day, I regret that I didn't call her, even still, you know.
And Tony Hogan also had this to say about the 11-day kidnapping of his colleague Des Hartford in 1997.
The amazing thing, he was only 11 days in captivity, but it seemed like a year. And the dangers only emerged afterwards about this second group of rebels who were trying to steal them, as it were, from the others. And these were more dangerous.
And they were all armed to the teeth with guns.
And his episodes, described actually by Gene Harrington in her book,
You have a book here now, it's called Murder in the Mission. It's a true story by Gene Harrington about Father Des Hartford and Father Rufus Halley. So this was searing stuff.
Yeah. So the danger was increasing, because the group he was with were now not only running away from the military, they were also trying to evade this other group, which was more dangerous. So it's a harrowing experience. But as I say, Gene Harrington describes it in this book, Murder in the Missions, because Des was writing a diary while he was there, you know. And of course, so 11 days, but it took me maybe a year to recover.
Profuse thanks to Tony Hogan for a great interview. Until our next programme of Out and About, from myself, Paul Wright, bye for now.